Welcome to The Spirit of Things. I'm Noel Debien.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
Ramadan has started, and that would be the Adhan, or Muslim call to prayer. The word comes from the Arabic for listen, and I remember well listening to it coming from minarets in Istanbul. I heard it in Delhi, and I heard it in Dar es Salaam. Well, smartphones are tending to make the Adhan profession a little bit precarious these days, but, God willing, it will be heard this Ramadan from atop of Australia's almost but not quite yet completed mosque. It's in Punchbowl in Sydney's southwest. About 20,000 people live there. It's ethnically diverse, it's a residential suburb, about 35% of the people are Muslim, and the most commonly spoken second languages are Arabic, Vietnamese, Greek, Bengali and Urdu. St. Jerome's Catholic Parish there and St. Sharbel's Maronite Monastery Church are very attractive. Punchbowl's Uniting Church and St. Saviour's Anglican are very appealing too. St. Nicholas Antiochian Orthodox Church in Punchbowl is quite unique to look at. The Mormon Church is also lovely, but I'm willing to bet heaven to a dollar that the new mosque, which so far has cost $12.5 million, is about to place Punchbowl right on the Australian art and culture map. The architect of this unique new building is Angelo Candelepas, who happens to be Greek Orthodox, and the building is actually up for an architectural award already. I asked Angelo how confident he was that he'd win.
It doesn't really matter for me. What's more important is that you offer something that has a cultural dimension that can touch people at every level, which has to do with the human spirit and how it can be touched by the things we create.
I went last week to look thoroughly, and Zach Matthews showed me around. Now, when I walked up first, I looked and I thought, oh, it's all concrete. The whole thing is a concrete structure. Like, it's poured, isn't it?
That's right.
Like a sculpture almost.
That's right.
And then I thought, where's the minaret? There's not an obvious minaret here. I can't see a huge tower dominating. Why is the minaret not as obvious as usual?
Well, it's the sound of the minaret that's important. It's the call to prayer. I think what's important is that the human voice has that intimacy of contact with you and that it's in a place where that can be offered meaningfully as the highest point in the building.
And then when we went inside, this is a low entrance as I'm going through this door. What's behind that low door?
An ability to imagine yourself entering a different space. And I think the very first spaces anyone imagined as architectural were in mountains and caves, feeling safe in a space.
I felt a little bit, I suppose, humble, because to go through that door, it was reassuring, it was close. Then you walk through into this enormous space, which was big and which was somehow warm, not too much light, but light was coming from behind me. And the first thing I noticed as I looked up were these honeycomb domes, sculptured like the inside of a beehive almost is what it looked like. 99 of them are important. Why are these little domes important? Tell us about them.
To create elements within it that give it a human scale. That sense of, you called it being humble. I like to think of the word meek, because in being meek, that enables you to then be disarmed. And I think always we're trying very hard as architects to bring a memory of all those things that we know, such that people that have fond memories of the things that they know or aware of, or things that they love. But what is more important is the element of the unexpected.
I had never seen these honeycomb domes. This is the first time in this country I've seen such a ceiling. And as I walked in, sort of facing towards Mecca, the light was sort of coming from behind me, from above at the back, and I looked up to see galleries. Now, what are those galleries behind? Tell us about those.
Well, in the ancient world, they were called the gynecanites, the place where women would worship. And I think it's a beautiful thing to see silhouettes through veils of any person. Let's call them dangerous shadows in the space. What's very beautiful about what your observation tells me is that there's many ways of seeing this space and experiencing it, and there's such warmth in the way that you talk about it. I think we all have to create works, as do poets, that reflect, make people reflect upon their own ideas and perhaps change them a little. and make them understand what they had thought before, or crystallise it in a way.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about my own prejudice. I come from a Western Christian background. I went up into the first gallery because at the moment, because the mosque was not open, I could go into the women's gallery. And here is the main dome, straight above me. Was there a purpose in placing the dome over the women's gallery?
You know, it's fantastic you ask this. I think the women are the centre of the mosque. The dome in Western architecture symbolised the eternal because really it was about the sphere. It was about understanding how spheres were endless because the beginning and the end is female. And from my point of view, not enough is offered to our community to venerate the presence of women. And I think I could make in this mosque that not was I trying to sideline women. I was trying to put them in the centre of the space, high, perched above the worshippers. Let's go right back to Ravenna at San Vitale. And it has in it this sense of a dome. And all the earlier churches at Mystra and in the south of Greece that were the first of a building type that was appropriated into becoming Hagia Sophia.
I've stood inside Hagia Sophia, and that's what else your dome reminded me of, because it's a similar sort of trajectory as Hagia Sophia.
I hope mine doesn't fall down, Justinian.
fall down, didn't it? It was a bit of a disaster. But it's back again.
And what's nice about it is its plan and how easy it was to appropriate that plan for the Blue Mosque, reminding us that there is this lineage in our faith, into the Muslim faith. If anything, out of San Vitale, Hagia Sophia, and even all of the mosques in Spain, we would say the Alhambra or in Cordoba, there's a beautiful sense of that which is repeated.
This is an interesting thing you brought up, though, because Hagia Sophia, of course, was the centre of Eastern Christianity, of Orthodoxy. That was the great cathedral. The empire, the Byzantine Empire, was defeated in 1453. It became a mosque. But not only did it become a mosque, they began to imitate this style because they needed roofs on the mosques because it rained. This was not Iran or Iraq, where mosques had large open areas. So this dome was actually linked to an ancient Christian cathedral. And you have, as a Greek Orthodox person, used a motif which can be seen in Hagia Sophia as well, I think.
There were two things that were asked of me. And one was to create a dome, and the other one was to create a minaret. Being of Greek Orthodox faith, the very first thing that I did was think, goodness me, am I going to need to create a dome? I hate domes, you know, why would I?
You're not supposed to say that as a Greek Orthodox man.
No, but you know, the moment is there, isn't it, as someone that's a little bit immature at that point. I think with maturity, though, I worked for 6 years under Col Madigan, who did the National Gallery, and then helped him for 10 years in advising the National Gallery. And I said to him, look, this client has come to me and said they wanted a dome. What do I tell them? And he said, what do you mean? I wouldn't give up that opportunity ever. No. That is the most wonderful opportunity, Angelo. And I thought, one of the things that's very important about architecture is that we leave beautiful ruins behind.
Oh, I hope it's not going to be a ruin. This one looks like it's going to last for hundreds of years, I've got to say, from the construction.
Ruins are there from buildings that were thousands of years old. Mm. And at a time when a building is almost complete, it looks more like it was meant to be a ruin than any other time. This is a time when we really are testing ourselves as to whether or not what we've created or what we've conceived of has a relevancy through time. And I think time is the most important critic of architects.
I wanted to ask you about how it's been described. I watched an SBS piece, and then I also saw that in CNN, it's gotten a lot of coverage. It's been described by STB as inspired by brutalist design, and CNN repeated that, what I would like to call allegation, because I don't agree, but how do you respond to the suggestion that it's brutalism, which I presume is because it's poured concrete? I think that's the link they're trying to make. Is that what it is?
It comes from an idea that Corbusier may have coined, the term béton brut, which is basically just raw concrete.
Yes.
The problem I have with the term is that it is a term of historical intentions. It was 70s, 60s, 50s architecture.
And not so polite, I mean, by the way, at the time, either.
I don't know if architecture of the Brutalist period is all Brutalist, and I don't know if people understand the term holy. I was a bit shocked that people were calling it this, and from my point of view, there was never an intention for it to be retrogressive.
The interior is certainly refined, is the way you look at it. When I look and I think inside of a beehive almost, it's almost delicate, even though it's concrete poured. How would you describe it?
One of the things that we are always attracted to is the curvature of form, both ways. But if it's holding itself as a cup toward you, then it's very welcoming. To repeat it thousands of times is such a delicate thing and so incredibly softening to the light. It's not an aggressive space. Mm. And I think that that is the thing that I would say distinguishes it from what we call brutalism.
Indeed.
Because the intention was never to be aggressive.
The other thing is when I saw in the little domes, there's light coming through each tiny little one.
Ah.
It's not just solid.
No.
Light penetrates like little tiny stars almost.
It is tiny stars. In the middle of every one of these domes, every single one has a 20-millimeter diameter skylight. The ideas of navigation have come from the Arabs.
Oh, from Islamic science,
from
absolutely.
From Islamic science. And I learned this when I went to the Kimball in Texas, of all places, and I saw this beautiful exhibition of Islamic instruments for navigation. They have created so many works of architecture with stars painted on the ceiling. Why don't we light this mosque from the outside and have the stars at the centre such that people can look up and discover them slowly?
Let me ask you about the religious connection or disconnection, because you're Greek Orthodox, you're a practicing Christian. When you were approached to build a mosque, do you do them often, or was this a surprise? How did you respond?
Oh, Noel, I think the term is freaked out. What do you say when someone asks you to do what could be one of the most important buildings, particularly when their aspirations are so lofty and they're such good people, really?
They have put down money for this. I think it's public, the figure. It's $12.5 million so far, and half of that was on the car park, which was required. So you only got half of that to play with for the top. But it was a lot invested by this community. They meant business. And you've been given a pretty free hand, haven't you, to achieve the design you wanted? Is that right?
It's a free hand as an architect. The client's needs, however, are a priority over yours. And if you can get those bedded down early, then you have a free hand.
Did I hear you went to your priest to ask him about this?
Yes, I did. I was going to say that. I prayed to God to give me some message. And nothing happened the next day, but the very day afterwards, I got a call for a church. And the day after, I got a call for the Great Synagogue.
Seriously?
And then the day after, I got another call for another church, and the day seven of these things happened. So I didn't know what to think, and one of the people who'd asked me to do something was actually Father Angelo of the Gladesville Church, and I think he's wonderful. So I confided in him. I've been troubled by it. He said, no, Angelo, you should never be troubled with these sorts of messages. They're very plain. It means that we are all the children of God, and you must do every single one of these projects, and they must be the most important projects of your life. My feeling in my bones is that it's not a coincidence that I've now got more religious buildings than I ever had before.
When you say you talk to various organizations of different religious backgrounds, which is really interesting, what about when you came to this building and it had to reflect the theology and its use and its worship, how Muslims think and connect to this building? How did you go about that?
Well, I hadn't realized that many of my friends were Muslim. I never thought of it, to be honest. But I knew everything about what they couldn't eat and where Mecca was. I knew all of it. The thing I didn't know was how similar we were. Our Christian faith has many similarities. And I would say those are the things that I'd like to concentrate on.
Now, the 99 names of God, they're not there yet. Because when I went in, that's not done. Now, I heard a rumour that there are some visa problems over the master artist. Have they been resolved yet?
Look, I think everyone thinks if you're a Muslim, you're a terrorist. Shouldn't say that. Yeah. I think it's silly. There are two gentlemen that want to come to our building and inscribe into the building names of God, and they're not allowed into this country.
What about neighbours? Because you mentioned people, you know, associate Islam with terrorism. It is a caricature that goes on. But we know that in Bendigo, when they applied to build a mosque, there was an action taken in the Victorian courts to try to stop it. It eventually got a yes, and it's going to go ahead. Did you have any of those sorts of negotiations happen while you were on this project, or was it a more happy process?
There are people everywhere that have a problem. And there's an element of persistence with any work of architecture. The worst example of treachery was in the requirement of the officers of the council to have one car parking space per two people. What we're doing is we're creating a mosque in a place where most people could walk, and yet there was an impost of a car park for 150 cars that made a three-storey car park under the building almost impossible for us to ever start the construction.
$7 million or something it cost just for the car park, as I understand it.
It's appalling. Well, I know churches, when they were war memorial churches in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, they were constructed with no car park.
Indeed, that was the case, yes.
And no, the reason parks. Why is because car parks are there for the frequency of use. And if you use a church once a week, it becomes nonsense, doesn't it, to require everyone to park at that place.
You've negotiated it. You're still smiling. And it's nearly finished.
It's nearly finished. I hope it never finishes, to be
honest. Per aspram ad astra, I think, is a through difficulties to the stars, is an old saying. And it looks like you might have made it almost to the stars. And they're in the little half domes anyway already.
That's right.
What about your own feelings about the building now? It's nearly done. It's nearly there. How do you feel about it?
It's always the case where you walk into a building and you can't imagine that you had the ability to do anything as accomplished. And so I think something else is at play, in a sense. I abandon myself to the process. But once you've finished the building and once it's done, it's the offering that matters. You have to not want to have any of it to yourself. And I think I've only been one very minor part in the history of this community.
You remind me, when you talk about that, of an old idea. I can't remember the exact Greek term for it. I think it was kenosis, or emptying. Have I got the word right?
Kenosis.
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 And you're talking about this. No, it's not about me. This is about offering. That is a Greek Orthodox theological principle, kenosis, isn't it?
Well, I must have learnt something from somewhere, Noel. Kenosis is a beautiful idea. You're right. I think I can't move on to the next thing unless I've emptied the last one. And it's nice, actually, as a feeling, to offer this back, having the most important ingredient is love, isn't it? And with that comes an enormous amount of suffering, and you can see both in this building. And that makes it real, from my point of view. Everything else that is in the process, in the path of the process, doesn't really matter. But those two things, love and suffering.
Angelo Candelepis, he's the architect of Australia's stunning new mosque at Punchbowl. You're listening to The Spirit of Things on RN with me, Noel Debien, and we're talking religious architecture this week. And my colleagues, Marion Chahab and Siobhan Hegarty, have both been to see the new building to check I was not just making this up. Marion, what did you think?
I thought it was really amazing. When I first heard about the mosque late last year and I saw that it was made of concrete, I thought, won't this be cold? Won't it be kind
brutal.
Of brutal and sterile? And but it was surprising because as soon as you walk in, it's very warm and inviting. Mm. It's like it hugs you. It's quite small, smaller than I expected. And yeah, it's incredible. Your neck hurts from looking up so much.
So Siobhan, are we being too effusive?
No, I think it's an architectural masterpiece. I haven't seen anything like it before in terms of religious structures. but I do watch a lot of renovation shows, and it reminds me of trends of quite groundbreaking architecture that's being done for commercial or domestic buildings, but I hadn't seen it before in a religious setting.
You got out there with a drone and stuff. You've done lots of shooting inside it, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. A colleague came with us to do some drone shooting inside the mosque, which gives you a bird's eye view of the concrete mini domes and just how many there are, but also the incredible labour that must have gone into making this building.
I can't wait to see it. But you didn't do the outside with the drone, why not?
No, that's right. It's too close to flight paths.
You mean they wouldn't stop the planes for the ABC in your drone?
Surprisingly, no.
You should have asked. You never know.
Yeah, indeed. Unfortunately, we weren't able to do any filming outside, but I really think that the inside is a spectacular part.
Mariam, you spoke to people, you rounded up some people inside to find out what the locals think of it?
Yeah, I spoke to a couple of worshippers and everyone's very excited about the mosque and really looking forward for it to open.
Well, tell us, who did you speak to first?
So I first spoke to Zina Kazi, and she talked about the role the mosque played in her life, especially as a new migrant when she came to Australia from India a couple of years ago.
When I came to this country, I came with a lot of questions in my mind. My husband was looking forward to starting a new life here, but obviously coming to a new country, I was anxious as well. But when I came to this country, and mosque is the first connection that you have with your community. So that's the place where you get socially connected and, you know, you feel like a part of a bigger community. And I think mosque is central to you feeling connected with your community. And we just got that from this mosque. When I came to this country, Australia is very proud to have a very, very multicultural community, and that is reflected in the Muslim community as well. I found friends from all over the world. We place a lot of emphasis in Islam on Islamic brotherhood, and I found the sisterhood in this community when I came to the mosque. We place a lot of emphasis on connections in the society. You cannot, as a Muslim, just cut off from the rest of the world and live your own life. You have to be a part of things that are happening around you. And I'm not restricting this only to the Muslim community. It's the humankind, the bigger humankind, that we have to give positive contribution to. And a mosque is the focal point from where you start that activity. So, it's a great honor that we have a very good leadership in this mosque. And especially the young people, looking at what is happening in the world, especially people who migrate to this country and starting their life afresh, it's very easy to get lost. So if you have good role models, if you have people who are telling you what should be the focus of their life, it's a very good direction and it's a very good guidance. And mosque plays a big role in that.
So what sort of impact do you think this mosque will have on non-Muslims and the perception of Islam in this country?
I think people get what they come seeking for. So for people who come with an open heart and open mind, this mosque would be a place that would give them the right window to Islam. And I have got a son who's 10 years old, slowly transitioning into his difficult age, I'll say. And I'm worried for him to find his identity. And I think this mosque would provide a place for him. So it's going to be a very, very important place, both for Muslims, Muslim youth, and for community in general.
So Zina's right into it. Who else did you manage to talk to? Cross-section?
Yeah, so then I spoke to a young man, Karim, and he talked about his hope for the mosque to attract young Muslim men like himself.
Yeah, my name's Karim Agag. I'm 21 years old. I'm Egyptian, I'm a student, I'm studying.
So how do you feel walking into a mosque like this?
It's quite different actually. I've been to many mosques in Sydney and also in different countries, and I feel like the architecture is a bit different. It carries connotations of some sort of European mosque. Most of it is wood and concrete, and it gives it this very serene feeling.
It's very modern, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very modern. But if it looks this good now and it's not even finished, the carpet hasn't been laid down yet, you can imagine how it will look when it's laid down. And also as humans, I think we like to be in touch with the environment we're in. So if you put someone in a nicer environment, they can concentrate in their prayer better, or they'll have a better quality prayer.
Do you think a building like this will attract young Muslim men in particular?
I think it will, yeah, because when the word goes around, it's very different. I've never seen, we were discussing, there's a sunroof in the dome, and we're not aware of any mosque in the entire world which has something like that. So when the word spreads, people want to see what this mosque offers. So I think, yeah, the youth will come.
Have you noticed that it's dwindling, that less and less young people are coming?
Yes and no. I mean, there is a bunch of youth who are starting to connect themselves with the religion, and they start coming to the mosque. And there are those who are starting to lose the Islamic identity, and they start going against the values of what we believe as Muslims. So I think to bring those people those youth into mosques, they need mentors, they need people who understand the time that we're in. It's a different generation that we're living in. And it's very important that people who have grown up in this environment, to be able to help those to live in the environment as an Australian, but to also keep that Islamic identity that they hold. So they have both Australian values and Islamic values. And I think it's not very hard to assimilate them together and make a person.
You could say that this mosque represents the new generation, can't you, with the design?
Yeah, you can. It does. It's very modern as well. And I think if one or two or even a few youth members go, you know, you start telling your friends, and friends tell friends, and word of mouth, and before you know it, we might have a great youth program here.
In terms of visiting a mosque, like, how often are you able to visit an actual mosque as a busy student?
Of course, I'm at uni during the day, but mornings and nights, you are at home. So I do try to make the morning and the night prayers at the mosque. So
which mosque?
I'm always around, sometimes Greenacre, Lakemba Mosque. There's a small Masala in Greenacre. There's Panchwa Mosque now, which is going to be happening. There's three or four different mosques in Lakemba, which I like to change the environment, not just go to one specific mosque.
So every day you go? Or
almost every single day I do go.
Wow.
Yeah, I try my best to go. Of course, if something comes up, maybe because we have morning prayers, maybe if you sleep in a bit late and the prayer started, you just pray at home. But most of the time, yeah, I do try to visit every day. The prayer takes 5 to 10 minutes, but sometimes I'm there for an hour after the prayer, because there's so many regular faces that you see. A lot of the youth are starting to come to the mosques as well. So you get to sit down. Food, like I said, Panchwa has food options like the other western suburbs. So we either sit down, we talk to each other, discuss the day, eat, socialise, just generally.
It's really interesting hearing Karim speak about the social aspect of the mosque. And I think for members of the Muslim faith, particularly migrants, having a place to worship and to meet other like-minded Australians is really important. And I think we forget about that a lot of the time.
It's true that churches have done the same thing over the last several hundred years for Catholics, for Anglicans, for Wesleyans. Synagogues have done the same thing. They've become social centres. And I notice it in Ramadan in particular, when they gather.
Yeah, definitely social, but not just that, educational as well. So you'll hear from our next worshipper, Ola, and this is what she had to say.
My name is Ola Qasim. I'm a mom of four. I've been in Australia for about 22 years now. Originally, we're Palestinian, but living in Jordan.
So for someone who might be in a different city like Adelaide, how would you describe Punch Bowl?
Punch Bowl is a place buzzing with multiculturalism, especially Middle Eastern. To me, it feels like home. The environment around, it feels like you're somewhere where you belong. It's not just about being muhajjabi and stuff like that. It's about
wearing the headscarf.
Yeah, the headscarf. It's about the shops, the people, stuff like that.
And how would you describe the mosque to someone who can't see it?
It's a very warming place. You feel like you're at home. At the moment, I feel like there is going to be a lot of activities happening here, and we're building new emotions towards this place, like attachment to it, especially with what we built with the old mosque where we had the other houses. When it was demolished, we were crying, like it was as part of us going. So we're hoping at the moment we'll build new memories, emotions for us and our kids in this place. So yeah, we're looking forward to see this starting, inshallah.
And what's your favorite feature here?
I think the whole thing is just, for me, is something different. it's a different look for what traditional mosques are, but at the same time, let's say it's something new for us to get used to. But I love it. I love the little domes inside. I love the big dome on top. Usually you see the chandelier coming and it's all that fancy stuff. This is more like modern and something relates to these days. A mosque have a lot of roles. Apart from praying every prayer and Friday prayer in particular, for our lives it's a place for Saturday school where kids learn the Arabic language and the Quran and the Islamic manners and Islamic studies and stuff. It's a place where we gather and have, for example, in Ramadan, all of us come here and have an iftar here. Like in the future, our kids will come and do their marriage ceremonies here. It has a lot of jobs. It's not just for a prayer. It's a lot of things we do here.
So a very social place as well.
Very social place, yeah.
And what about during Ramadan? What could you expect to see if you were to enter a mosque during the holy month?
You'll expect to see a lot of people praying, a lot of people reading their Quran, a lot of people worshipping.
Does it become so busy that people might lose their shoes? Has that happened to you in the past?
It never happened to me, but I know it happened to a lot of people.
Are you disappointed that it's not going to open in time for Ramadan?
A little bit, yeah, because we were expecting to pray here this year and see it from the beginning. We're hopeful we still have a chance to pray at least the last 10 days of Ramadan. And yeah.
What sort of impact do you think this mosque will have on young Muslims, but also non-Muslims?
Young Muslims, hopefully this place will be open for all young Muslims. And it's because of its design and the way it's been structured, they'll feel more into something that belongs to them here. For non-Muslim, it's going to be always open for them if they want to come and see it. And it's a very welcoming place for anyone who wants to come and see it and meet us and know about us generally.
I know it's been so many years in the making, I think 11 years, and it's cost more than $12 million. Mm. And a lot of it came from the community with fundraising. Mm. How concerned were you about the cost?
At the beginning, I felt it's a bit too much, but then I asked, and one of the brothers here, Brother Zakaria, explained where most of the cost coming from, and it's understood now where the costs are coming from and why it's costing this much. We would have hoped it wouldn't have cost that much, but realistically, this is how it is these days.
And what about from people that you know? Are people excited about this mosque? Like how are other Muslims feeling about this place?
From the people around me, they're all excited. They can't wait to come and pray their first prayers here. It's something we're all looking forward to. But as you can see, there's a lot of Muslims at the moment and a lot of Muslim centers. So I don't know about the others, but for the people around me, I think they're very excited to come and see this established and starting.
When the mosque does open, how long do you think will it take for you to get from your house to here?
From my house to here, it takes me about 10 minutes now. It could take me 15, 20 minutes. It depends on what time of the year it is.
And the day as well.
Yes. You don't want to know when it's Eid or it's ridiculous. It becomes very busy
better
everywhere. But it's better to walk maybe. Yeah.
You're on Radio National. This is The Spirit of Things. I'm Noel Debien. We're talking religious architecture, particularly the mosque, the new mosque at Punchbowl. Now, one of the key community members who's been part of the planning, the fundraising, the community building and all the negotiation is Dr. Zachariah Matthews. He's currently the Vice President of the Australian Islamic Mission in New South Wales. That's the organisation that's overseeing the project. I visited the incomplete mosque a fortnight ago, and Zach was hopeful then that it might be finished for Ramadan, but there were a few things standing in the way. To be complete, 99 names of God are yet to be painted in gold within each of the 99 poured concrete domes. They form the honeycomb interior ceiling, and it's amazing to look at. I asked Zach if they had managed to open the new mosque for the beginning of the fasting month of Ramadan.
Unfortunately, we did not.
So why? What happened?
We were trying very, very hard to have the opening before the start of Ramadan. Our plan was to bring out two calligraphers to come and paint the 99 names of God in these Makanis mini domes. We got the visa for one of them, but not for the second.
Oh, but the second one, if I understand it, is the master calligrapher. He's an Iraqi who's living in Turkey. Have I got that right?
Correct. He was the teacher of the other calligrapher for whom we obtained a visa. Fortunately, we got the visa for the third calligrapher that we tried, and they're still in that process.
How long is the calligraphy project itself, 99 half domes? How long does it take to complete this?
If two of them are working on it simultaneously, they could finish it in 2 to 3 weeks.
Oh, so quick.
Just the 99 names. But there's obviously a lot of other work that we'd like them to do as well. The full package of everything that we'd like them to do is 4 to 6 weeks.
So, Zach Matthews, it's nearly ready, but how long has it been in the making?
It started way back in 1994. Fortunately, the property that we rented, 29 Matthew Street, was already approved as a Muslim place of worship.
Ah, right.
Another Muslim group went all the way to the High Court in Canberra, took them 17 years to get it approved as a place of worship. So they did all the hard work for us.
That's a long time, 94. That's 22 years?
Yeah, going on 23 years.
Going on 23 years to get it to the point that it's at now. Yeah. Well, I hear the mosque is actually up for an award, though. The Sydney Architecture Festival is involved, is that right? Am I hearing correctly?
The Architecture Festival showcased the mosque as part of their festival last September. And I think Angelo has submitted it for an architecture award. And he's trying very hard to get it near completed for them to come and do their judging.
Well, when I walked in, I've got to say, I think it's going to be a signature piece of architecture for Australia. I think it's a very significant piece of religious architecture. And certainly when I walked in, I went, wow. And this is just the raw interior at the moment that I've seen. The cost.
When we started the building part of the project in October 2015, up to now, about $12.5 million.
And you had to raise this from the community?
Yes, we have. We raised some in donations and a larger component in loans. So we have a non-interest-bearing loan from a bank, plus we have loans from individuals within the community.
So it's a Muslim-acceptable loan, in other words,
correct,
according to Muslim banking?
Correct.
How about the reaction of the community? When you do a signature building, I remember when the Opera House was being made, a lot of people were outraged that so much money was spent on this building. And anytime you do anything of significance architecturally, I think it's fair to say that there will always be someone within a community who says, this money would be better spent on X or Y. What sort of responses have you had there? Because I've seen you actually defending this online.
Firstly, we had two major decisions to make. What type of material to use in constructing this mosque? If we took the easy option, we could have saved money. Mm. But we took an option that we go and build it out of concrete. The reason for that is it will last a long time. So it might cost us more money now, but in the long run, we'll actually save money because the building will last for a long time. The second consideration was council has a 45-degree envelope from the boundary fence of our neighbours that we could not build beyond.
Oh, okay.
From the back and side where the mosque sits.
Is this about privacy or something?
Yes.
It? Right.
It's privacy and light and sun, not obscuring the property adjacent to us. Mm-hmm. So Angela was forced to design those two ceilings at a 45-degree angle. Again, the consideration there was whether initially he thought about building it in a stepwise fashion to get the 8-meter height that he eventually wanted the dome to sit on top. When he came across a mosque with the Makanis mini domes in them, he took advantage of that. He said, okay, let's use that 45-degree angle, but put the Mekanis mini domes in them rather than having a plain, flat, 45-degree angled concrete ceiling.
And when you say Mekanis, you mean this like this honeycomb effect inside is what you're talking about?
Exactly. The Arabic word is Makarnas, but it's a honeycomb vaulted mini dome kind of shape that or feature that you find in a number of mosques around the world.
I've never seen one in this country. Are you aware of any other place in this country that has this Mekanis honeycomb mosque?
I don't think so. I think ours will be the first.
Just to go back to, you know, this 45-degree angle and light and stuff, I want to ask you about the neighbours and locals. I mean, I don't forget that when Bendigo Mosque was being built, there was a lot of to and fro, and it went to the Victorian courts, and eventually it was approved. But I know you deal with advocacy work all the time, Zach. How much of this sort of stuff did you have with neighbours and locals? How did you work with them to say, look, it's going to be a mosque here? And how did you get them on side or not?
I think, fortunately, there's a difference between Panchpal and Bendigo. Panchpal has a longer history of Muslim presence. Because this project was going for such a long time, since 1994, we had an opportunity to build good relations with our neighbours, as well as with the local council. And I think that helped facilitate our project gain approval.
Are the neighbours generally Muslim, or is it mixed? I'm interested in the local area demographically.
It's mixed. According to the last census, 2016, 35% of the people living in Panchpal were Muslim. So it is a pretty high proportion of the community.
Just describe where Panchpal is in Sydney. Where does it fit as a suburb?
Panchpal sits in the southwest, close to Bankstown, right next to Lakemba, which has another large mosque in Sydney.
And a lot of, I think, Greek Orthodox out that way, as I recall. There are Greek Orthodox churches around the area, certainly in Belmore and places like that. That's not far away, is it?
Yep, there's a large Greek Orthodox church in Belmore. And that was the church that Angela was involved with building or designing their school for them.
Oh, which brings me to Angelo, because your architect is, of course, Greek Orthodox. And he's not just nominally Greek Orthodox. He is Greek Orthodox. He worships and he's connected to the church. When you made that choice, how was this choice considered? How did you end up with a Greek Orthodox architect for a mosque? And how did the community respond when this became clear?
It was mainly on a pragmatic basis. We knew that we were going to submit an application, a development application with Canterbury Council for both a mosque and a primary school. So we canvassed, we inquired, and a councillor on Canterbury Council suggested that we look at Angelo because he had seen Angelo's work coming through council and that he knew that Angelo was involved in the school attached to the church in Belmore. That's how it all started, basically. And then when we looked at Angelo's profile, we were quite happy to go ahead and then we met with him and discussed the idea, the project with him.
Now, you mentioned he was designing a school. Now, this complex originally was going to have a school too, a primary school, wasn't it? What's happened with that? Because I know it's not going ahead.
At this stage, we've shelved the school component of it, mainly due to funding again.
Right.
Because we have all these community loans that we still need to pay back.
Now, I can hear, Zach Matthews, you have, I think, a South African accent, am I right?
Yes, I do.
So how long have you been in this country? And how has your experiences growing up a South African helped you with this project?
I've been in Australia since 1990, so almost 28 years. I spent 2 years in the States before I came to Australia. And Americans have a very good way of somehow molding one's accent. But I still have remnants of my South African accent there, especially when I get a bit exhausted and tired, then it comes up more prominently. I grew up in Johannesburg, in Joburg, South Africa. I grew up coloured and non-white because I'm of mixed race. I was born Muslim. My parents were born Muslim as well. Islam has a long history in South Africa, more than 300 years.
Yes.
So I'm ethnically Anglo-Malay. I was classified as Cape Malay, coloured. There were four categories, white, Indian, coloured and black. So all the mixed races were in the coloured category. But even in the coloured category, we had a number of different subcategories and I was classified as Cape Malay.
Now, for younger listeners, when you say categories of coloured, non-coloured, what did that mean in the South Africa you grew up in?
It meant that I grew up in a coloured neighbourhood We lived in a separate coloured neighbourhood. I went to a coloured primary school, a coloured high school.
You were under apartheid?
Yes, I lived under apartheid. I left South Africa in 1988. Apartheid finished and came to an end in 1994.
Oh, well, Australians must seem a pushover to you then, do we?
In what sense?
Well, if you had to live under apartheid, I've always wondered what the experience would be like, because we know that a lot of South Africans have moved to Australia because they think it's similar. You know, this reminds us of home. We're happy to be here. Now, you're coming from the category of coloured, who weren't, I think, on the top rung, were they?
I guess it's similar in the way that it has a British system of governance, similar to what South Africa was when I was there. But it's also different in that South Africa was overtly racist in terms of the system of governance, whereas Australia had moved on from that. So that was a good change for me, coming and living here. There are still aspects that are similar in terms of racism and how people of colour are dealt with and treated in this country that I can relate to.
Oh, well, you picked me up the other day. In fact, while I was reading about you, I assumed you were Caucasian. I just assumed because that's how you look. And we know that's not always how it actually works, particularly with Indigenous Australians. You can't always see that somebody's Indigenous. But you picked me up and said, no, I'm coloured. And I thought, oh, I haven't read that term for years. That was in books that I read when I was a kid. And I wondered straight away, does it help you when you come into a place like this and you've got to negotiate to put up a mosque? If you've lived in that culture where there was segregation and was much stricter and much harsher, I think, than here in this country, did that help with your negotiating skills, do you think?
It does help in a way. The kind of phobia that we're experiencing today is Islamophobia. So I can relate to that. And the amount of resilience that I had to develop living in South Africa helps me in terms of dealing with the differences and how to manage diversity and deal with those aspects of society that are not comfortable with change. And noticing that the landscape in Australia, the demography of it is changing, and that change can be managed and it can be good for the country.
Now, what about the ethnic composition of your mosque that you're building? Now, you're a South African by origin. Who else is there? What's the makeup of your community?
We're quite a diverse community. The larger proportion are Arabs, but even amongst the Arab membership that we have, it is mixed. But predominantly, we have Lebanese Muslims living in that area of Punchbowl in Sydney. More recently, we've had people from the Southeast Asian region move into the area, people from Bangladesh and India and so forth.
So the Bangladeshi people would not necessarily speak Arabic, I think. So you've got a language issue developing as well, or are they all English speakers, or how does that work?
That is an issue for us as a mosque. So traditionally, our Friday sermon, for example, the first part of the sermon will be given in Arabic, and the second part, we've introduced this a long time ago because we recognize that even the younger generation who come from Arabic-speaking families don't necessarily hold on to the language. So we've had to add an English summary to our Friday sermons as well. And that helps cater for the broad cross-section of the community that we have in terms of language.
And now, are we talking predominantly Sunni?
It is a Sunni mosque, yes. Right. It is a Sunni community as well.
But I presume, if I understand it, Shias will worship in a Sunni mosque and vice versa, for convenience.
Yeah. Depending where they are, it doesn't really matter.
It's not a traditional-looking mosque in one sense when you stand outside. I didn't see a huge minaret. There is a minaret, but it's not huge. Once it's inside, it feels traditional to me, even though it's very modern. But from the outside, how does it compare to other mosques that you've prayed in before?
It is completely different.
Why?
It's modern, but ancient at the same time. I think because of the material that was used, the concrete. For me, it gives it that ancient look that when I walk into it, even looking at it, it all really looks like an ancient ruin, despite the fact that it's new.
Now, carpet. I know that carpet is important in mosques. Where's the carpet coming from and what's happening here?
We got the carpet from Turkey. It was made...
Turkish carpet.
Turkish carpet.
Best in the world.
It's made of 60% Kiwi wool.
Oh, good.
And 40% Turkish wool.
Oh.
Sadly, no Australian wool.
Oh.
But we do have our neighbours, the Kiwis, involved. So
they're part of Anzac as well. They're part of Anzac. What about younger people in this community? I wonder, certainly Christian churches, Jewish synagogues have challenges in keeping younger people engaged. What's your experience with this mosque?
We face the same challenge of how to engage young Muslims, especially to the mosque. With the design that we have and the significant status or iconic status that this mosque will get, one of my other hopes is that will be enough of an attraction to get the youth to attach themselves to the mosque.
For the listener who's not seen it, hasn't seen any photographs yet, describe this mosque.
If you're walking past or driving past, it might catch your eye, but you might miss it.
Because it's set back.
It's set back.
And it's not huge.
Exactly.
Huge.
So it doesn't impose itself on the environment. It fits in nicely to its surrounds. It doesn't stand out as a mosque. For me personally, it looks like an ancient building. Mm. And that's attractive to me.
Well, it has the dome, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I know that Hagia Sophia was the origin of the great mosque design as well in Istanbul, that this was something that took because they needed a roof, because it rains in Turkey. It's not like an Iranian mosque where you can have it in the open air. And so you've got the dome, which is like the Turkish-style mosque, don't you?
Exactly, yeah. And I think Angelo, the architect, mirrored what those mosques look like. And originally his plan was to have a copper dome, similar to the Turkish-designed mosques. But copper was going to be too expensive for us.
So oh, it's very expensive.
Yeah.
No, it's very expensive. Zach Matthews, can I ask you, how hard is it to build a mosque in Sydney?
It is a challenge. The first challenge is getting it through council. Fortunately, because of the work that we did with council, we didn't experience the same difficulty that other mosque projects experience.
Well, how do you feel about it now after this time? Because I imagine this is like one great act of giving birth, to quote Christian scripture. But how do you feel that it's very close to completion?
I'm very excited. I'm very excited. I can't wait to have it finished, for us to actually open it up, to get the community to come and pray there. I can't wait for that.
What are your hopes for this building?
My hope is that it will serve the purpose for which it was built. A place of spiritual renewal, where Muslims can come and perform their prayers, but the building itself will add to that experience. That is my hope. And then it will be worthwhile.
That's Dr. Zach Matthews, Vice President of the Australian Islamic Mission in New South Wales, the group that's overseeing the completion of Punchbowl Mosque, which hopefully will open its doors this Ramadan. Now, Siobhan Haggerty, remind us where we need to go if people want more.
That's right. So we'll be putting up an article which has photographs so you can really see for yourself what the mosque looks like, as well as the people that you've heard from, including Zach. And if you're curious about the drone footage that we've mentioned,
oh, yes.
Keep your eyes peeled, head to the ABCRN Facebook page, and we'll be putting up a short social video for you early next week.
Good, thank you. Now that's it for The Spirit of Things this week. Thanks this week to producers Ian Coombe, to Mariam, to Siobhan. The head of ABC Religion and Ethics is Joe Gelonesi. Music and guest details will be on the website, as you've just heard, along with audio streaming and downloading. And if you feel like it, you can subscribe to our podcast using the ABC Listen app, so you can listen to everything again, and you can also find anything you've missed. It's all online for your absolute convenience. I'm Noel Debien. Next week on The Spirit of Things, we'll be chatting with American Jesuit and chaplain to the stars, James Martin. The editor of Vogue, Anna Wintour, actually declared him the best dressed at the recent New York Met Gala. Seriously. But we won't just be talking fashion, we'll also be discussing the religious state of President Trump's America. So that's it for The Spirit of Things. It's goodbye from Siobhan Haggerty.
Goodbye from Mariam Chahab.
And goodbye from Noel Debien.
دوما قريب ليتك دوما قريب.